Chapter 31. Had folded and handed to her, with the injunction to deliver it at once to Mr. Boyne. Mary finished her luncheon, still wondering, and when it was over, and Trimble had brought the coffee to the drawing room, her wonder had deepened to a first faint tinge of disquietude. It was unlike Boyne to absent himself without explanation at so unwonted an hour, and the difficulty of identifying the visitor whose summons he had apparently obeyed made his disappearance the more unaccountable. Mary Boyne's experience as the wife of a busy engineer, subject to sudden calls and compelled to keep irregular hours, had trained her to the philosophic acceptance of surprises. But since Boyne's withdrawal from business he had adopted a Benedictine regularity of life. As if to make up for the dispersed and agitated ears, with their tanned-up lunches and dinners rattled down to the joltings of the dining car, he cultivated the last refinements of punctuality and monotony, discouraging his wife's fancy for the unexpected, and declaring that to a delicate taste there were infinite gradations of pleasure in the fixed recurrences of habit. Still, since no life can completely defend itself from the unforeseen, it was evident that all Boyne's precautions would sooner or later prove unavailable, and Mary concluded that he had cut short a tiresome visit by walking with his caller to the station, or at least accompanying him for part of the way. This conclusion relieved her from farther preoccupation, and she went out herself to take up her conference with the gardener. Thence she walked to the village post office, a mile or so away, and when she turned toward home, the early twilight was setting in. As he had taken a footpath across the downs, and as Boyne, meanwhile, had probably returned from the station by the high road, there was little likelihood of their meeting on the way. She felt sure, however, of his having reached the house before her, so sure that, when she entered it herself, without even pausing to inquire of Trimble, she made directly for the library. But the library was still empty, and with an unwonted precision of visual memory she immediately observed that the papers on her husband's desk lay precisely as they had lain when he had gone in to call him to luncheon. Then of a sudden she was seized by a vague dread of the unknown. She had closed the door behind her on entering, and as she stood alone in the long, silent, shadowy room, her dread seemed to take shape and sound, to be there audibly breathing and lurking among the shadows. Her short-sighted eyes strained through them, half discerning an actual presence, something aloof, that watched and knew. And in the recoil from that intangible propinquity she threw herself suddenly on the bell rope, and gave it a desperate pull. The long, quavering summons brought Trimble in precipitately with a lamp, and Mary breathed again at the sobering reappearance of the usual. "You may bring tea, if Mr. Boyne is in," she said, to justify her ring. "Very well, madam." "But Mr. Boyne is not in," said Trimble, putting down the lamp. "Not in? You mean he's come back and gone out again?" "No, madam. He's never been back." The dread stirred again, and Mary knew that now it had her fast. "Not since he went out with the gentleman?" "Not since he went out with the gentleman." "But who was the gentleman?" Mary gasped out, with the sharp note of someone trying to be heard through a confusion of meaningless noises. "That I couldn't say, madam." Trimble, standing there by the lamp, seemed suddenly to grow less round and rosy, as though eclipsed by the same creeping shade of apprehension. "But the kitchen maid knows, wasn't it the kitchen maid who let him in?" "She doesn't know either, madam, for he wrote his name on a folded paper." Mary, through her agitation, was aware that they were both designating the unknown visitor by a vague pronoun, instead of the conventional formula which, till then, had kept their allusions within the bounds of custom. And at the same moment her mind caught at the suggestion of the folded paper. "But he must have a name. Where is the paper?" She moved to the desk, and began to turn over the scattered documents that littered it. The first that caught her eye was an unfinished letter in her husband's hand, with his pen lying across it, as though dropped there at a sudden summons. "My dear Parvis, Who was Parvus? Have just received your letter announcing Elwal's death, and while I suppose there is now no farther risk of trouble, it might be safer, she tossed the sheet aside, and continued her search. But no folded paper was discoverable among the letters, and pages of manuscript which had been swept together in a promiscuous heap, as if by a hurried, or a startled gesture. But the kitchen maid saw him. Send her here, she commanded, wondering at her dullness in not thinking sooner of so simple a solution. Trimble, at the behest, vanished in a flash, as if thankful to be out of the room, and when she reappeared, conducting the agitated underling, Mary had regained her self-possession, and at her questions pat. The gentleman was a stranger, yes, that she understood. But what had he said? And, above all, what had he looked like? The first question was easily enough answered, for the disconcerting reason that he had said so little had merely asked for Mr. Boyne, and, scribbling something on a bit of paper, had requested that it should at once be carried in to him. Then you don't know what he wrote? You're not sure it was his name? The kitchen maid was not sure, but supposed it was, since he had written it in answer to her inquiry as to whom she should announce. And when you carried the paper in to Mr. Boyne, what did he say? The kitchen maid did not think that Mr. Boyne had said anything, but she could not be sure, for just as he had handed him the paper, and he was opening it, as he had become aware that the visitor had followed her into the library, and as he had slipped out, leaving the two gentlemen together. But then, if you left them in the library, how do you know that they went out of the house? This question plunged the witness into momentary inarticulateness, from which she was rescued by Trimble, who, by means of ingenious circumlocutions, elicited the statement that before she could cross the hall to the back passage as he had heard the gentleman behind her, and had seen them go out of the front door together. Then, if you saw the gentleman twice, you must be able to tell me what he looked like. But with this final challenge to her powers of expression, it became clear that the limit of the kitchen maid's endurance had been reached. The obligation of going to the front door to how in a visitor was in itself so subversive of the fundamental order of things that it had thrown her faculties into hopeless disarray, and she could only stammer out, after various panting efforts at evocation, "His hat, mum, was different, like, as you might say, different? How different?" Mary flashed out at her own mind, in the same instant, leaping back to an image left on it that morning, but temporarily lost under layers of subsequent impressions. "His hat had a wide brim, you mean? And his face was pale, a youngish face?" Mary pressed her, with a white-lipped intensity of interrogation. But if the kitchen maid found any adequate answer to this challenge, it was swept away for her listener down the rushing current of her own convictions. The stranger in the garden. Why had Mary not thought of him before? She needed no one now to tell her that it was he who had called for her husband and gone away with him. But who was he, and why had Boyne obeyed his call? Ivy. It leaped out at her suddenly, like a grin out of the dark, that they had often called England, so little a confoundedly hard place to get lost in. A confoundedly hard place to get lost in. That had been her husband's phrase. And now, with the whole machinery of official investigation sweeping its flashlights from shore to shore, and across the dividing straits, now, with Boyne's name blazing from the walls of every town and village, his portrait, how that rung her. Hawked up and down the country like the image of a hunted criminal, now the little compact, populous island, so policed, surveyed, and administered, revealed itself as a sphinx-like guardian of abysmal mysteries, staring back into his wife's anguished eyes, as if with the malicious joy of knowing something they would never know. In the fortnight since Boyne's disappearance there had been no word of him, no trace of his movements. Even the usual misleading reports that raise expectancy in tortured bosoms had been few and fleeting. No one but the bewildered kitchen maid had seen him leave the house, and no one else had seen the gentleman who accompanied him. All inquiries in the neighborhood failed to elicit the memory of a stranger's presence that day in the neighborhood of Ling, and no one had met Edward Boyne, either alone or in company, in any of the neighboring villages, or on the road across the downs, or at either of the local railway stations. The sunny English noon had swallowed him as completely as if he had gone out into Cimmerian night. Mary, while every external means of investigation was working at its highest pressure, had ransacked her husband's papers for any trace of antecedent complications, of entanglements or obligations unknown to her, that might throw a faint ray into the darkness. But if any such had existed in the background of Boyne's life, they had disappeared as completely as the slip of paper on which the visitor had written his name. There remained no possible thread of guidance except, if it were indeed an exception, the letter which Boyne had apparently been in the act of writing when he received his mysterious summons. That letter, read and reread by his wife, and submitted by her to the police, yielded little enough for conjecture to feed on. I have just heard of Elwell's death, and while I suppose there is now no farther risk of trouble, it might be safer, that was all. The risk of trouble was easily explained by the newspaper clipping which had apprised Mary of the suit brought against her husband by one of his associates in the Blue Star Enterprise. The only new information conveyed in the letter was the fact of its showing Boyne, when he wrote it, to be still apprehensive of the results of the suit, though he had assured his wife that it had been withdrawn, and though the letter itself declared that the plaintiff was dead. It took several weeks of exhaustive cabling to fix the identity of the Jarvis to whom the fragmentary communication was addressed, but even after these inquiries had shown him to be a Waukesha lawyer, no new facts concerning the Elwell suit were elicited. He appeared to have had no direct concern in it, but to have been conversant with the facts merely as an acquaintance and possible intermediary, and he declared himself unable to divine with what object Boyne intended to seek his assistance. This negative information, sole fruit of the first fortnight's feverish search, was not increased by a jot during the slow weeks that followed. Mary knew that the investigations were still being carried on, but as he had a vague sense of their gradually slackening, as the actual march of time seemed to slacken, it was as though the days, flying horror-struck from the shrouded image of the one inscrutable day, gained assurance as the distance lengthened, till at last they fell back into their normal gait. And so with the human imaginations at work on the dark event. No doubt it occupied them still, but week by week and hour by hour it grew less absorbing, took up less space, was slowly but inevitably crowded out of the foreground of consciousness by the new problems perpetually bubbling up from the vaporous cauldron of human experience. Even Mary Boyne's consciousness gradually felt the same lowering of velocity. It still swayed with the incessant oscillations of conjecture, but they were slower, more rhythmical in their beat. There were moments of overwhelming lassitude when, like the victim of some poison which leaves the brain clear, but holds the body motionless, she saw herself domesticated with the horror, accepting its perpetual presence as one of the fixed conditions of life. These moments lengthened into hours and days, till she passed into a phase of stolid acquiescence. She watched the familiar routine of life with the incurious eye of a savage on whom the meaningless processes of civilization make but the faintest impression. As he had come to regard herself as part of the routine, a spoke of the wheel, revolving with its motion, she felt almost like the furniture of the room in which she sat, an insensate object to be dusted and pushed about with the chairs and tables. And this deepening apathy held her fast at Ling, in spite of the urgent entreaties of friends, and the usual medical recommendation of Page. Her friends supposed that her refusal to move was inspired by the belief that her husband would one day return to the spot from which he had vanished, and a beautiful legend grew up about this imaginary state of waiting. But in reality, yes, he had no such belief. The depths of anguish enclosing her were no longer lighted by flashes of hope. She was sure that Boyne would never come back, that he had gone out of her sight as completely as if death itself had waited that day on the threshold. As he had even renounced, one by one, the various theories as to his disappearance which had been advanced by the press, the police, and her own agonized imagination. In sheer lassitude, her mind turned from these alternatives of horror and sank back into the blank fact that he was gone. No, she would never know what had become of him, no one would ever know. But the house knew, the library in which she spent her long, lonely evenings knew. For it was here that the last scene had been enacted, here that the stranger had come and spoken the word which had caused Boyne to rise and follow him. The floor she trod had felt his tread, the books on the shelves had seen his face, and there were moments when the intense consciousness of the old, dusky walls seemed about to break out into some audible revelation of their secret. But the revelation never came, and she knew it would never come. Ling was not one of the garrulous old houses that betray the secrets interested to them. Its very legend proved that it had always been the mute accomplice, the incorruptible custodian of the mysteries it had surprised. And Mary Boyne, sitting face to face with its portentous silence, felt the futility of seeking to break. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.